Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But please don't call unless we ask for calls, because right now we have on the line from Oklahoma, Craig Roberts. And Craig was in Vietnam. He was in the military. He retired from the reserve as a lieutenant colonel. He worked at the police force there in Tulsa, Oklahoma for many years. I've written a number of books, certainly one of our favorite guests here. Good evening, Craig. How are you doing?
Oh, doing good tonight.
Well, tell us what your take is on the things that are going on. Do you want to perhaps cover a little bit about your concern about the terrorist threat here in America, the possibility that there actually may be suitcase-type bombs here that were going to be used to retaliate against America?
Well, Dr. Stan, we knew, quite some time back that the Spetsnaz had left several suitcase nukes inside this country, the Spetsnaz being the Soviet Union's Special Operations Forces. And we knew that they also had some that were in Chechnya that the Chechens later sold to different Islamic terrorist groups through Pakistan. And we think that they may have found their way into this country through Mexico. We know the MS-13 street gang, according to intelligence sources, has evidently been assisting in bringing Arab terrorists into this country from Al-Qaeda and other sources, and possibly at least two modern, much more recent versions of these mini nukes. Now, when we're talking about nuclear explosion on these types of devices, what we're really talking about is something that's relatively small, but it's dirty. We had what we call backpack nukes that we had in Europe, and those special forces would use those in case the Russians came through the Fulda Gap and made a mad dash for the English Channel. As we withdrew, with the fighting withdrawal, the plan was to use these to blow up bridges and blow up dams and, major highway intersections and command and control points and runways. They're called SADM, subatomic demolition munitions, and what those are used for is basically to destroy key points by just leaving one device there, setting a timer, and then getting out of there. The bad thing about the Russian ones is you can't go in afterwards in a relatively short period of time, because they use types of uranium and plutonium that basically are dirty, and they contaminate not only the area, but they contaminate the water, they contaminate any of the metal structures around there for a long time. And until you get some really hard rains and stuff to decontaminate these areas, it's uninhabitable. So the yield on these and, the blast radius on one of these nukes, let's say if it was in downtown New York City, would probably only be 6 or 8 square blocks. It's not like the Hiroshima mushroom cloud type nuclear device. They're not up in that megatonnage range. But they're big enough to create a huge panic, a large loss of life, destroy a lot of real estate, and make it where it's basically uninhabitable for, 10 or 15 years. If they've got two of them in this country that we know about, and they wanted to set those off any time in the near future, like September the 11th, coupled with the damage we had to these hurricanes right now, it'd be a total disaster.
Well, I share your concern, and certainly you have certain connections that make you believe that this is really more than just a rumor.
Oh, absolutely. I've still got friends in various places in the military that they talk about these things, and we got briefed on it before I left. We were afraid of it here, and we were afraid of it in South Korea as well. We know that there's some stuff over there, that if the North ever decides to invade the South, that there's probably going to be some things that are going to be set off in South Korea to deny us a way to stop the advance.
Well, that thought there. We'll be back in just a moment here with one of my favorite guests, Craig Roberts. Well, Craig, talking about this, certainly, do these need a lot of maintenance? Do they have to be updated? Do they have to be resupplied, or can they certainly sit there for a matter of years?
Well, you know, we hear the old thing of, well, they wouldn't be any good anymore because the batteries, you know, would be run down, and they need a lot of maintenance. They really don't. I mean, they're pretty simple devices. They're pretty much solid state, and the only batteries you need are to set off the detonation charges that set off the nuclear device. And, you know, if you know the voltage and the amperage, you can go down to the local car parts store and buy whatever you need to set up in series or parallel or whatever it takes. It doesn't take an electrical engineer to do this. All you have to do is know, you know, that you've got a certain circuit in there that requires, you know, positive and negative lead with certain amperage and voltage. So that's not an issue. The devices, you know, as long the actual subatomic demolition is basically, you know, will last forever. Now, did the Russians have them in this country? Yes, we know they did. What did they do with them at the end of the Cold War? Well, they left them here. They're hidden along with military supplies and other things, in various, you know, locations. Most of it's in a rural area. They don't put too many of these things around cities because they're afraid of our means of detecting them. So the typical Spetsnaz operations back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s was to buy rural property, buy a farm, put two or three people there farming, and they would, you know, smuggle these things in, they would bury it, they would build a fallout shelter to put this stuff in, and they would have it, and they'd be ready as sleeper agents to come out and use it whenever necessary. They would have targets already designated to them. Let's say there was one in South Dakota, in a certain area, and they knew that nearby was a missile silo, and they knew if they were given a certain code word that within so many hours they had to get this device over and put it on top of the missile silo or whatever, as an example, or a road intersection, or, you know, a major dam, whatever would cause a lot of confusion or would create an impediment to our military to react to any type of an operation. In Europe, the object of the exercise, of course, was to blow up command and control stations and to bottleneck us up to where we couldn't maneuver our combat elements in retaliation to any push through the Fulda Gap that the Russians did. So all of these things, would come into play. The Cold War ends, and this stuff's still out there. And with the Russian economy the way it was, they're willing to sell anything they had. I remember one story from a Russian colonel.
Hold that thought for just a moment here, because what we want to do is bring our other stations back on board. And, of course, I don't want you to tell the story, be in the middle of it, as we begin pulling in our stations from out across America. So just hang on for a moment. Well, Dr. Stan here, our guest this evening is Craig Roberts, and he's talking about the fact that these suitcase type of nuclear devices, small nuclear devices, certainly the Russians had a lot of them at the end of the Second World War, and they were desperate for currency, and so they were really up for sale. So pick up the story.
It would put them outside in the rural area someplace, so it would be harder to detect, so that if the sleeper agents that were going to use these things for knocking out bridges and dams, highway intersections, command and control centers, and airfields, and so on, they all had pre-designated targets where they would employ these devices. Well, they weren't that far away. They would just have to move them, 10, 15, 20 miles, or to a major city if that was the target. The Cold War ended. A lot of these guys, went home. They weren't on the payroll anymore. They left everything behind, well hid, well camouflaged, and they could go back and get it if they needed it. We know that the Russians were selling just about anything that they could get their hands on as individuals. The entire Russian army was up for sale, so was the Air Force. If you wanted to buy a tank, if you wanted to buy a MiG jet, no matter what it was, it was available if you had the money. I remember one story that I was talking to a Russian colonel, and he said in one village, he said that one of the commanders that was in the local military installation there sold the village a brand new T-72 tank, complete with all the equipment and armament, and for several cases of vodka. And the villagers took this tank and they drove it around and had fun with it and crashed through the woods and everything till they ran out of gas, and they ended up beside the road. Just they shot the cannon a few times and partied it up and just left it there. So, you could get anything if you had the cash to get it. Well, we know that the Islamic terrorist groups, you know, they're not actually insolvent. They've got a lot of money to spend. They got a lot of oil money behind them. There's families in Saudi Arabia that are multi-millionaires that are helped funding terrorist operations such as the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and all the rest of them, all of them, the fundamentalists. And they go to Peshawar, Pakistan, and to the arms markets there, and they can buy anything they want. We know that the Russian and the Chechens, especially the Muslim Chechens and Bosnians, had access to a lot of these nuclear devices, and they sold them to these Islamic terrorist groups. Now, where they went to from there, you know, I don't have that information, but I'm sure we've got government sources that have been able to track some of it. Some of the same things happened to our Stinger missiles. We had 500 Stinger missiles in Afghanistan that disappeared at the end of the Afghan-Russian war. Where did they go? And when I asked that question, you know, before I left the military, the answer was, well, it really doesn't matter because the batteries wouldn't be any good. Well, and as I explained, you know, in the first segment, the batteries are inconsequential. You can come up with batteries for anything. You can hook enough flashlight batteries in series to make things happen. You don't have to have something that came from the manufacturer. You just have to have something that fits in the compartment and has the right voltage and amperage. Well, they know that too. And so I think that probably two Stinger missiles may have been what was involved in TW-800, and they don't want to admit it because they don't want to admit that some of our own equipment came back to haunt us after we provided it to them to fight the Russians with. Well, those are just simple examples. We know that they had them and still have them in South Korea, that there are sleeper agents in South Korea that have nuclear devices, that their targets are airports, government buildings and installations and you know, bridges and so on. In case the North ever invades the South, they'll be able to compartmentalize the Southern resistance and the American forces in given areas, or contaminate the battlefield where you can't cross it anyway because these are dirty nukes. Inside the United States, we know recently it's been in the mainstream media that they believe that two small nuclear devices, suitcase nukes, whatever you want to call them, has crossed the Mexican border, which right now you could drive the entire Russian army across the Mexican border, I think, because there's not anybody stopping them. The MS-13 gang that came out of El Salvador is now scattered all over the country, and they are extremely ruthless, extremely dangerous, and they've been paid $20,000 per person to smuggle Islamic terrorists across the country, across the border, and bring them into the country. Along with that, these guys are bringing their own materials. I've got a friend who works on the border down in Arizona, not far from Fort Huachuca, toward Tucson, and he said that they recently went into a ranch house there that had been abandoned by the ranchers. These people up there just walking off and leaving the places because of all of the illegals coming across and scaring them, coming right up to their house at nighttime and banging on the door and so on. And they had abandoned this one ranch house. Well, these guys went in, agents went in there, and they evidently, there were some people who were there who just ran off into the desert when they saw their vehicles approaching, and they left behind some goods. Well, some of the stuff, they had Korans, they had prayer rugs, they had notebooks in Arabic, they had a backpack that had all kinds of terroristic-type literature and so on. So they know these people are here. They know they're coming across the border. They know they're disappearing, you know, into the Netherlands up here. Mexican illegals, for instance, in Oklahoma, we've got over 65,000 illegals in Tulsa alone now. The east side of Tulsa is looking like East Los Angeles. And that's, you know, pretty far from the border. It's about 500 miles from the border. But still, we're on I-44, which is a branch of I-40, which is an interstate highway, and they come right up it. So we know that they're coming across. Well, along with that, you're getting the Islamics that don't have to worry about coming through airports. They don't have to worry about coming through ports. And they're here. Now, September 11th is coming up. That's a possible date that we need to look at real hard if they wanted to do something, or even if they didn't want to wait that long, because of the hurricanes. Now that we've got everybody deployed either in Iraq, South Korea, or in the Gulf area, and we're actually pulling National Guard troops back from Iraq to work in the Gulf, then, you know, we're stretched pretty thin right now. We found out that in New Orleans alone, the police department was good for about 24 hours. I've worked when I was on the police department in Tulsa where we had tornadoes. Our police department could work about 48 hours before we were totally exhausted, and we had to have National Guard troops there to take over the roadblocks and the roving patrols and so on. because we just, you know, between the actual police calls for the rest of the city, plus trying to handle the areas that have been destroyed by tornadoes, plus trying to deal with the infrastructure and so on, we just weren't geared and equipped to do that. Budget didn't allow for the number of personnel it would take on the average day-to-day basis to handle the overload. It's the same way with every city in the country. It's the same way with every state. We just got 2,000 evacuees out of Louisiana at Camp Gruber, which is a National Guard training area just south of where I'm at, and we've activated the entire state emergency management system to deal with this, plus brought in the Highway Patrol, which is our version of the state police. So, you know, every extra asset we've got is in that one location trying to deal with just that. Arkansas did the same thing with Fort Chaffee right across the border. Fort Chaffee's a relocation center. It's been there, and it's a National Guard area, but it's been used for the Cubans during the Mariel boat lift. I was there when that occurred. And it was used for the Vietnamese after the fall of Saigon. I was there when that happened. And I know what it's like dealing with these refugee centers. We're seeing that all over the country now. We're seeing, you know, thousands and thousands of displaced persons being put in other states, being spread out, and it's straining the emergency management system with a disaster of this magnitude. This is like having an earthquake that hit the entire state of California. When you look at the real estate and you stretch it from just west of New Orleans all the way over to the western tip of Florida, you're looking at an area that covers the whole southern half of California. So imagine more towns in California than what you've got right now, because, you know, you're looking at San Diego and Los Angeles, the beach towns, and then there's really not too much until you get up toward San Francisco. Imagine all of that being populated, and that's the way it is when you look at Gulfport, Biloxi, New Orleans, Pensacola, and all the rest of it. So you're talking about a lot of people, and they're having to be spread out over the entire eastern, southeastern half of the country, all the way up to and including Minnesota, and even up into the New England states now. So that's just what we've got going on right now. If we add a terrorist event on top of this, or an earthquake in California, or a Mount St. Helens type deal, whatever it is, the country's going to have its backbone broken. We don't have any more assets to deal with it. We're already using the 82nd Airborne down in the South. Our active duty military, 90% of it's overseas. There's no one home. This is what we've been talking about. This is what we've been worrying about for the last year and a half or 2 years, that if we don't keep some assets at home here, if something happens here, I don't know what to tell you.
Well, all I can say is I think the American people have to understand that the Second World War ended in 1945. We're still occupying Germany. Well, the Second World War ended in 1945. We're still occupying Japan. You know, the Korean War ended in 1954. We still have massive troops in South Korea. I don't know, 30 or 40,000. We've got troops in 130 nations throughout the world, but we don't really have enough troops here in the United States to defend America. And where is the outcry from the people? They seem to accept this as perfectly normal, and it's not. We have no business being in all of these other countries. We should be defending America and let the rest of the world, you know, defend itself. But, of course, we have no defense for America. And I share your concern, Craig. I think that we could be in very real trouble. And, you know, when you have your opponent on the ropes, why, that's when you go after them. And there really are people who hate America. And what a wonderful time for them to strike again. So I share your concern that something else big could happen, you know, and if it does, why, heaven help this country.
Well, I think you and I both know, and we've talked about this in the past, that there's elements higher than we see on the 6 o'clock news who are instrumental in dealing with these things and coupling up with their own personal agendas. And when we get back from the break, we'll go into who might benefit from all of this.
All right, fine. Well, I think that certainly those who listen to our programs regularly recognize the fact that there really are spiritual forces. There is an occult hierarchy that rules the world. If you have not read my material on the occult hierarchy, let me suggest you go to our website, www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com, and read the May and June 2005 newsletters, The Occult Hierarchy Part 1, The Occult Hierarchy Part 2, and of course if you don't have access to the internet, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, that's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for a copy of The Occult Hierarchy 1 or 2. Well, Craig, why don't you pick up the story from there?
Well, you know, I work part-time for a congressman here in Oklahoma on the Veterans and Law Enforcement Advisory Council. And I asked him here just recently, I said, look, and he's a Republican, and I said, look, I said, everybody here would like to know what's going on because we want to know what the White House says about the southwestern border. You know, we've got all of this stuff going on. We can't even defend our southwestern border. The whole Southwest is being taken over, basically an invasion that is backed and supported by the Mexican government and the Mexican Army. We have Mexican Army patrols coming across the border escorting these illegal immigrants now. It is an invasion. This isn't people coming over here to pick fruit and go home with the money. They're coming over here. They're staying. A lot of them are criminals. A lot of them are running drugs. A lot of them are, you know, carrying bags of money with them and bringing them this direction to finance operations over here. The Mexican Mafia is highly involved in this. What is the deal? How come we can't get the Bush White House to come out and do anything about it or even talk about it? And this is Congressman Sullivan, and he said, I don't know. He says, we've asked that same question on Capitol Hill. He said, we've asked several times, what are we going to do about the southwestern border? And it's total silence. And he said he thought it had to do with, you know, dealing with the Hispanic vote, and you didn't want to, you know, you want to be politically correct. You didn't want to offend anybody because of a racial issue and so on. And we all know that's hogwash. These people aren't Americans. These people are illegal. They're violating the law. And they're creating a criminal environment and even marching in the streets in San Diego saying that they're going to overthrow everybody in California, throw them out and make this a new, you know, Mexicali or something. And, you know, they're even putting on brown berets and fomenting revolution, and nothing is said. And so, you know, when we look at this, well, we go back to some of the other programs we've done in the past about, you know, the New World Order and the globalist and all of that. We talk about NAFTA. We talk about GATT. We talk about, you know, dissolving of the borders. We talk about getting away from nationalism and getting into globalism. And we say, well, who benefits from this? Who's doing this? Well, we go back 200 years. We can go back to the Rothschild plan. We can go to the things we've talked about with the Royal Society for International Affairs, the Council on Foreign Relations, elements in the UN, all of these guys, and they have one purpose in mind, and that is to destroy not only this country, but every country that is nationalistic and meld us all into this one little New World Order globalist community. And 10 years ago, people laughed, and they said, well, it couldn't happen here, and you guys don't know what you're talking about, and that's just conspiracy theory. Well, it's not theory. It's conspiracy, but it's not theory. It wasn't only in the works. It wasn't only planned. It's been happening, and we're seeing it happen down. We are in the last 10% of the plan right now. 90% is accomplished. This country is being reduced through something called redistribution of the wealth and internationalism. You know, I mean, we've seen our factories going overseas, we've seen our jobs going overseas, we've seen foreign labor come into this country and take over about everything. You know, I mean, when's the last time you went to a hotel or convenience store that was run by an American? These people are from India, Pakistan, Mexico, and so on. We've seen this, but what we're seeing is we're seeing this nation being lowered to something called the second world status. Now, everybody says, what's that? Well, we know that there's the first world out there. That's the United States and the Europeans and the Australians and Canadians and the industrialized Western type countries. Then we know there's the third world, which is pretty much backward, poverty stricken, and so on.
Well, Craig, you're going to have to hang on to that because we're going to be bringing our other stations on board just about right now. So just one moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Craig Roberts. And Craig was talking about why we're not closing the border. And it's Craig's belief, and I certainly agree with him, that there is an organized effort to impoverish the American people, send our jobs, send our factories overseas, to bring in a lot of people who will work for a lot less money, to gradually lower the living standards of the United States to that of a second-rate nation or second-world nation. We talked in the past about the first world countries like the United States and Europe, and then the third world countries like Africa and certain parts of Asia. But of course, we have great, great wealth there. We prospered greatly, but there really are people who hate America, who intend to redistribute our wealth. And if you doubt that, you need to read the Earth Charter, point number 10, written, of course, by that great American patriot, Mikhail Gorbachev, and Marie Strong and Stephen Rockefeller. The Earth Charter, point 10, talks about redistribution of wealth within nations and between nations. And that's really what you're seeing today, is redistribution of our wealth throughout the world as they move intentionally and purposely and methodically to impoverish the American people. So pick up the story there, Craig.
Well, you know, we've seen it happen in our lifetime. You know, from 1947 on, when they first started the United Nations, we had gone, you know, I remember when I was a kid, what's the United Nations? Oh, it's this wonderful organization that they've gotten together and everybody's going to work together so we don't ever have another war like World War II. There's going to be peace in our time. There's going to be this, that, and the other. And the first thing that happens is we have two wars break out. One in Indochina, which was the French Indochina War. It started in 1950. And the other one was in Korea, which became our Korean War. And the French Indochina War was left up to the French to fight against the Vietnam Men, led by a guy named Ho Chi Minh. And the Korean War was left up to us mostly, but a few other countries, Britain and Canada and Turkey and a few others, South Korea, to fight as a UN operation. Well, the globalists manipulated the situation where Ho Chi Minh threw the French out, basically by 1954, the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. End of 1953, we were allowed to fight the Korean War to a truce. We didn't win it. We didn't lose it. They stopped it at the 38th parallel, signed the truce accords at Panmunjom, and we've been at war ever since. Korea is the longest war in United States history because we are still in a war in Korea. They call it a police action. I don't care what they call it. When bullets go two directions, that's a war. And so we have that situation over there. That communist government in the North was allowed to continue to exist, supported by the Russians and the Chinese.
Oh, don't forget, though, we give them a lot of support, too, in the way of food, in the way of oil, building a nuclear plant for them. Then upset because they have a nuclear plant. We've got to do something because they may build nuclear weapons. Not only the Chinese and the Russians, but we've been supporting them as well in the name of humanitarian aid, which, of course, keeps the ruthless dictator in power. Doesn't make much sense, but then so many things don't make much sense.
Well, it's all above our pay grade. We're not supposed to understand these things. However, let's go back in history just a little bit and educate some people. And if you read my book, The Medusa File, I go into a lot of this in detail. My website at riflewarrior.com, or you can get it through Dr. Stan, carries it in stock at Radio Liberty as well, The Medusa File, Crimes and Cover-ups of the U.S. Government. That book right there goes into this, what I'm going to tell you in more detail. And at the end of World War II in 1945, we'd stockpiled thousands of tons of weapons in Okinawa for the preparation to invade the Japanese home islands under an operation called Operation Olympic. As it turned out, we didn't have to invade because after we bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Japanese surrendered unconditionally. The troops all got to come home except those that occupied Japan under MacArthur and so on. However, no one asked what happened to all of the equipment that was left in Okinawa. And we see the old Victory at Sea movies and the old black and white stuff where it shows them pushing jeeps and airplanes off aircraft carriers and so on. And we go, oh, they threw it all in the ocean. Well, no, they didn't. There was some old stuff they got rid of so that they wouldn't flood the surplus market when they came home. The military didn't want it brought all the way back. And all these guys wanted to do was get home and get on with life because now the war was over. But all of the stockpiles of the weapons that were left in Okinawa were turned over to the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, under General Wild Bill Donovan. William J. Donovan, who just at the same time happened to be head of the Council on Foreign Relations. As such, he worked a deal, and those weapons were divided up and sent in two different directions. One was to a place called Indochina to a man named Ho Chi Minh, who had helped us fight the Japanese in Indochina, which later became Vietnam, during the war, and also to South Korea. Now, this is 1945 to 1946, 1947. Well, 1950, we have war break out in both places. Ho Chi Minh uses our weapons to fight the French. All brand new, all not used. He took it, 105 howitzers all the way down to machine guns. And same thing happened in South Korea.
And that is the most amazing story, actually, we have in our JFK four-tape set, why we have a two-hour interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was formerly the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA. He tells exactly the same story. We ended up arming Ho Chi Minh, one of the finest enemy ever bought with American money. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Craig Roberts. Craig, pick up the story, and that really is such an amazing story. Most people don't understand that it was the American supplies in Okinawa that financed Ho Chi Minh, that gave him the military weapons that he used against the French, and later, of course, some of those weapons were used against our own boys.
Well, when we start going through history, we find that we've done this over and over again. Since World War II, we look at all of the stuff that we left inside of the Third World Central American community after the Bay of Pigs. We armed all kinds of governments. We armed all kinds of small armies and so on, from Guatemala all the way down into South America, with tons of American airplanes and tanks and rifles and carbines and ammunition and so on. We did the same thing for the Cubans that were going to invade Cuba and so on. And then we go to Vietnam. When we left Vietnam, we left almost everything we took over there behind. We left helicopters, we left fighter planes, ammunition, M-16s, everything it takes to run an army, we left it there. And of course, then it was captured by the North Vietnamese when they invaded the South in 1975. Now, you got to remember, and this is something that I like to reiterate every time I get a chance, is we didn't lose the war in South Vietnam. We won it. They gave up in 1973. They signed the Paris Peace Accords, and everybody was happy. Nixon's Vietnamization was basically, let's get out of there while we can and let them have it. We'll give them all the gear and all the money, and then they can take it from here, because the North promised not to invade the South, and Henry Kissinger worked a deal. Well, 2 years later, when they knew that the political sentiment in this country wasn't going to let us go back and bail the South Vietnamese out, the North invaded the South. The rest is history. Saigon fell. All of the arms and equipment we left behind entered the international arms market. The North Vietnamese army didn't want it. I mean, they had all their own equipment they got from Russia and China. They took all of this stuff, everything from helicopters to guns to explosives, and it entered the international arms market, not only to other governments, but basically to subversive governments, governments that were anti-American. A lot of it went to Gaddafi
in Libya,
and then others. Some of it went to Syria, some of it went to Yemen, and so on. Different Arab terrorist-supporting countries around the world. A lot of it went to the Philippines and ended up in the hands of the Abu Sayyaf and the communist guerrilla groups. So that's where that stuff went to. It went to Malaysia, went to Indonesia. That's our equipment that we left behind that did that. You know, there's a movie that Burt Lancaster was in called Go Tell the Spartans. It was filmed back in probably the 70s, but it's about a major in...
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening is Craig Roberts, and talking about how, of course, we'd get left, first of all, we'd had all the goods on Okinawa at the end of the Second World War, and half of them were sent to George Washington of Indochina, a man named Ho Chi Minh. He used that then, of course, against the French, against the Americans. Then after America left Vietnam, why, we left all of our military supplies there, our rifles, our small arms, our ammunition, our jeeps, our helicopters, and of course, much of this was then bought up by Gaddafi, by other anti-American governments. In other words, we left all that equipment there, and the North Vietnamese, then they're selling it to the enemies, so-called enemies of the West, but nothing is ever as it appears to be. And then Craig was talking about a movie that had Burt Lancaster in it many years ago. You want to tell the rest of the story, Craig?
It was called Go Tell the Spartans, and he was an advisor for Military Advisory Group Vietnam in 1962 in this movie. He's a major, been around the horn a few times. And if you get a chance to go rent that movie, folks out there, go find it. It's a great movie because it's very realistic. It was really the way it was about 1962. I was there in 65 and 66, and it hadn't changed much. And I was an advisor for a month of the South Vietnamese Rangers, and I felt just like Lancaster did in this movie. It was just incredible to watch it. But there's this one part where he's getting ready to support this little outpost that they were ordered to go man. And he went to see the local district chief, the commander of the South Vietnamese Army there. And he goes in and he's talking to this guy, and they pour a couple of drinks and everything. He says, look, he says, I'm going to need some fire support in case we get hit out there at this village. And your 105s are within range, and we'd like you to, be able to support us in this if we need it, because we don't have anything bigger than mortars. And he says, well, I don't know. He says, There could be a coup. I could be called to help Saigon. You know, I only have so many rounds of ammunition. And basically what he was saying was that it was a status symbol to have 105 howitzers, number one, and the number of rounds you had, you polished up and you put them on display. If you had, you know, 50 rounds of 105-millimeter howitzer rounds, you were, you know, a pretty important fella. And so these were status symbols, and he didn't want to shoot any of these up because it would take away from his status symbols. And Lancaster says, well, you know, we'll provide the ammunition. In fact, we'll give you all the ammunition we need and then some, as long as you can give us fire support. And then the guy says, well, if we don't use it, he says, what happens if they want it back? And Lancaster said, he says, the United States has never, ever asked for anything back. He says, they wouldn't know how to. It'd mess up the whole system. And he made a point there that kind of, when we're talking about leaving arms and equipment where it falls into the hands of the bad guys, that's basically the way it works. You know, we really don't bring the stuff home. We leave it over there. Then it ends up being used against us or against some of our friends. And that's a sad state of affairs when we can't, you know, deal with situations like that. If you look at Somalia and Mogadishu, people don't hear the story, but we've got the book Doorway to Hell, Disaster in Somalia, that General Ed Wheeler and I put together, that tells the real story behind the scenes and how the UN was really messed up in this deal. And what had happened was when we pulled out of Somalia after the second operation, which was called Continue Hope, and the troops that were over there called it Abandon Hope, but when we pulled out, we left everything behind. We left bulldozers, we left trucks, we left cranes, construction equipment, supplies, everything we took over there, we left it. And we turned it over to guess who? Brown and Root. Now, when we go to Brown and Root, we find some friends that were Lyndon Baines Johnson's buddies when he was president and during the Vietnam War. Brown and Root was a contractor that was the one that dredged out Cameron Bay. And Cameron Bay we didn't even need, and the Vietnamese wanted to dredge it out. They wanted the money, but instead we hired this outfit out of Texas, which was Johnson's home state, to go do this.
Now, aren't they somehow tied into Halliburton today, Brown and Root?
Brown and Root, Halliburton, and two or three others of the big construction companies are, you know, they all you know, get the same contracts and work the same deals. But Brown and Root built the airfields over there. They built some of the bases and so on. They did the same thing in the Philippines. But what's interesting is when they built a lot of the construction in Cameron, the steel came from Red China, and the concrete came from North Vietnam by way of Hong Kong. And I couldn't believe that when I found that out. And it was real interesting that the same people we're fighting are selling us the stuff to build the bases to fight them with. And no one seemed to notice this because the cutout was Hong Kong or Singapore. But that was actually happening. We also know that Brown and Root ended up getting the contract to build the Johnson Space Center in Houston. And it was simply because Johnson was president that he worked a deal where Brown and Root could take this swampland, turn it into Johnson Space Center, and then bring in enough dirt to build a town around it so that they would have housing additions with all the construction company stuff going on that Brown and Root built, shopping centers and so on. They built a whole community there out of swampland. That wasn't good for anything before, and they made a ton of money on that. So all of these things were going on behind the scenes, the political hierarchy. But if we go one notch above these guys, or two notches above them, and we find out that our globalists are the ones really pulling the strings, saying, okay, this is where we're going to go, this is what you're going to do when you get there, and this is what's going to happen when you leave, we see the same pattern over and over and over again, just like it was pulled off the shelf of the big, massive blueprint. After we saw, Desert Storm, we left a lot of stuff over there. The same thing with, we talked about Mogadishu at Somalia. Same thing in Beirut. When we were in Beirut, we left a lot of stuff over there. And then later on, we find out a lot of it gets into the international arms market, and then it's used against us, or it filters back into this country, or to a country that's unfriendly to us.
And it's like deja vu all over again. All over again.
It just happens. And no one jumps up and down, screams and yells because the administrations keep changing, but the plans continue on the same way they always do.
And I think it's so important that people understand there really are these forces out there that to control both the Republican and the Democratic Party. And every 4 years we go to the polls and we vote for the candidate of their choice. And it really doesn't matter which party, which candidate loses, their man always wins. So once you understand that, and there is another agenda, and that's the New World Order, the New World Religion, then you can understand why we're not trying to close the border, because they want to do away with national sovereignty. Then you can understand why, of course, there's the attack on Christianity in this country, because they want to do away with Christianity. And when you understand the common denominator, when you've read the plan, and you can read it right there in the Earth Charter, it's up on the Internet, written by that great American patriot, Mikhail Gorbachev, and, of course, Marie Strong and Stephen Rockefeller. Get it, read it, understand. They're so blatant in what they're doing. In fact, they even keep the Earth Charter in the Ark of Hope, which is the demonic, satanic counterpart of the Ark of the Covenant, because both Marie Strong and Mikhail Gorbachev say this is the new Ten Commandments to replace that outmoded Ten Commandments. When you understand there's a conspiracy against God, then it all begins to make sense.
Well, you know, when I do lectures and stuff, it gets to the point where, you know, a lot of people have a learning curve that stops at a certain point, and they just refuse to look above that level. And they say, well, you know, who are the real bad guys? Who's in charge at the top? Who's the ones pulling all the strings? And they expect me to come up and tell them about some secret committee that meets in Frankfurt or London or someplace. And that stuff happens, but that's not the top of the pyramid. And an interesting point was when I was working on the book Killzone, the sniper looks at Dealey Plaza. I finished the book, and the hardest thing for an author to write is two words, the end. You just can't quite get there. You keep thinking there's something more I've got to do, there's something more I've got to add. You know, you've got to sooner or later just say, that's it, I'm done, there's the book, here's the words, the end. And I wanted to end it with something, and I keep thinking, you know, okay, I followed this Kennedy assassination through this, you know, 3 or 4 year investigation that I was involved in, all the way up through the levels above Washington, because you had to ask yourself a question on the Kennedy assassination alone. You had to ask yourself one question: who was able to organize it, field it, finance it, pull it off? You know, have a patsy and set him up on the deal, then control the investigation afterwards, destroy evidence, intimidate witnesses, kill witnesses, influence or control the Warren Commission, then seal all the records to the year 2029 and manipulate both houses of Congress, the FBI, the CIA, and the White House, and do it for every administration that happened after 1963. Was there a power high enough to control basically most of Washington? And of course, the research in the book on Killzone, we chased that level up, and we found that yes, there's an organization. It's called the Council on Foreign Relations, and they pretty much have their people every place, and they're globalist, and they want their little new world order, and they want to control all the banks and the Federal Reserve and all of this stuff. And you know, you get up to that point, you say, boy, I solved the case, there it is, it's these guys. You know, Kennedy was going to do it, the Federal Reserve, he was going to pull us out of Southeast Asia, and that was going to get the CIA away from trafficking in drugs, and so on and so on and so. And then it finally gets to you that, wait a minute, there's people in there that are at the very top that are taking their orders from somebody. I mean, they just don't pull us, you know, out, you know, over all of these years and all of these decades and make it work. Somebody's got to be in control of them. So who could that be? And I paced my office. It was midnight one night. I remember it very well. And I paced my office, and I said, okay, Lord, tell me now, you know, give me a clue. And I had a pretty extensive library and filing system like yours. And, of course, we don't want anybody to look at how we file things. We'd be embarrassed. But I looked up in the top shelf, and I picked up a book, and I laid it down, and it was the Bible. And I flipped it open, and I just put my finger down, and it fell on Ephesians 6:12. And it said that we were fighting against, you know, principalities and rulers of darkness in high places. And basically it said, it's Satan. So I went back, I put that section, or I put that verse at the final section of the book, and then I had to go back and start doing some rewriting, because it finally dawned on me that what we really had was what I already knew, being a police officer for over 20 years at the time, that there's two forces at work in the world, good and evil. Good is controlled by Satan, controlled by God, and evil is controlled by Satan. And unless we understand that, we don't know whose side to fight on, and we can be manipulated by either side. And so I go to these meetings, and I go to these seminars, and I give these lectures, and people say, well, you know, who's at the top? And I say, well, I'm going to tell you right now, it's Satan. He does exist. He's out there, and the bad guys who are working for him believe in him, pray to him, and do everything they can to get power from him. And then they, end up, you know, they get money, they get power, they get political positions, they do all this stuff, and they'll do it any way they can get it. If they have to kill people, they'll do it. If they have to manipulate people, they'll do it. If they have to bribe people, they'll do it. They're using evil methods to get into evil positions of power. Now, the good people are having to fight against that, but we don't have those kind of earthly assets and resources. We have to use spiritual resources. We have to do it with morals. We have to do it with knowing what's right. We have to do it with courage. And we have to know we're on the side of right, and we win in the end. That's the only tools we've got. And that's more than sufficient. It worked all through the Bible. It worked through all the biblical stories. I mean, there were handfuls of guys that went out and with God's help defeated entire armies. So it can happen. But you have to have the faith to do it, and you have to have the willpower to do it. And that's about where I lose some of these people. I remember some of these militia guys out there going, well, you know, they're attacking the Second Amendment. We got to do this, and we got to do that, and we need to form more people, and all this stuff. And I said, guys, until you understand who you're fighting, you can't prepare for it. You know, you can't fight a battle you don't know who the bad guy is. And so you've got to understand that we have two wars going on. We got the physical war that we see in the newspapers and on the 6 o'clock news, and we have the spiritual war that you don't see, but you know it's going on around you all the time. You know, the angels and demons are fighting all around us all the time. And we have to understand they're out there, it's happening. We may not see it, but it's happening. We have to understand it's occurring, and it influences us, because the powers that are involved in the good versus evil are the same things we deal with on the streets every day, as policemen, as citizens, as soldiers, sailors, whatever. That's just the way it is. And they will use a religion against another religion. They'll use a race against another race. They'll use a country against another country. They'll use anything they can to accomplish their methods, and they don't care how many on each side is lost in the process. You know, the Chinese had a saying during the Vietnam War that they would assist the North Vietnamese to fight the Americans right down to the last North Vietnamese, because they weren't losing any Chinese. They were still fighting us, but they were using somebody else to do it. And that's how these people think.
And you're absolutely right. I think it took me about 20 years at this battle before I finally realized that the most simple answer was exactly what you said. It's a spiritual battle. And I got started in 1962, and I guess I was a slow learner, because, you know, I always knew I was missing something. I knew the enemy was communism, but it was more than communism. I knew the enemy was the great tax-exempt foundations, but it was more than that. I knew all about the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderbergers and the Masons and the Rosicrucians and the Theosophists and the OTO and down the list of all the secret and covert organizations, the Bohemian Grove, the Skull and Bones. And it wasn't until I really, one day, just took a step backwards and came to realize that there is this spiritual dimension, that you begin to see how it all fits together. And it's only by taking that approach that we are ever really going to be able to be effective. Because we're not going to solve this problem politically, although we should be involved politically, but we're not going to solve it politically, because it's a spiritual battle being fought on a political battlefield.
Well, you know, you said it so well. You gave a speech, and I think I've got a tape of it someplace, and I think everybody ought to have it. And I think it's a videotape, as a matter of fact, of a speech you gave. And you said, you told a story about all the different organizations who you thought it was this and you thought it was that, and just like you said. And then you said, you told the story of the murder on the Orient Express.
That's the Brotherhood of Darkness video, right?
And it's great, and I think everybody ought to get a hold of that, because I sat there and I had to watch it two or three times, because you did such a fantastic job. And it wasn't that one person killed the victim. Everybody stabbed him one time. It was a death of 100 cuts. So all of the organizations are involved, but they each make their own cut, their own knife stroke.
Amen to that. Well, at first that was a takeoff on Agatha Christie's story, The Murder on the Orient Express. And it really, if you haven't seen it in some time, it's worthwhile getting and seeing it with Sean Connery and so many wonderful actors. But the story is basically, you know, the detectives trying to figure out who killed the victim. And as Craig said, there was no one person who did it. They all did it. And this is exactly what's going on today as we face this overwhelming movement that permeates every aspect of our lives, is intent upon destroying the faith of our children, the finances of our country, and the very heart and soul of this once great Christian nation. Well, Craig, you know, I think that we just have to keep getting the message out over and over again. Like a minister, neither you or I are ministers, but we've got to put this spiritual message out because so many of the ministers just aren't doing what they, I think they're called to do, and that is making people understand the spiritual battle.
Well, that is so true. I wrote a piece on newswithviews.com. If you go to newswithviews.com, I go down, read my articles, and there's one of them there that talks about the lukewarm church and the preachers that we've got that are afraid to step on anybody's toes, afraid to offend anybody. They don't want to endanger their tax-exempt status. They do the same vanilla, canned lesson sermons every Sunday. They just mix the words around a little bit. And everybody goes and they sit and they say, okay, I went to church, so I'm good for another week. And that is so wrong now, because we are definitely in the end times, and these preachers need to stand up, and they need to be outspoken. They need to attack all of the things that are attacking us now. We need to fight back. We need to attack homosexuality. We need to attack a government that wants to do away with our Second Amendment. We need to attack globalism. We need to attack political correctness. I mean, all of these different things that are happening to us right now, attack abortion and so on. We need to fight back, and we need to be the loudest voice on the block, and instead we've got a lot of what I call wussy preachers out there that are afraid to tell the truth.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up this evening's program. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Craig, let's get your website out there. Let's get, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, they can go to Rifle Warrior. That's rifle as in gun, warrior as in soldier. All one word, riflewarrior.com, and I've got a lot of good articles on there now that I've written. I've got a lot of good subpages that you'll find interesting that tell a little bit about me and what I do and some of my hobbies and so on. And of course, all the books, and I've even got some books that are out of print now on PDF files there that you can get and download to your own computer and read or print out however you want. So it's riflewarrior.com.
RifleWarrior.com, great information there. And incidentally, is your book on the missing witnesses or the dead witnesses, is that still available or not?
It's out of print. Those copies are going for up to $200 on Amazon now if you can find one. However, because of that, I went ahead and put it in a Adobe PDF file. It's on my website, and you can get it there for like, I think it's 11 or 12 bucks. Download it to your computer. It's the actual book I put into PDF format, so you get everything right there.
Well, maybe we ought to go ahead and you and I ought to reprint that sometime. I think that's an important book because it certainly points out that what were there, well over 100 of the people who witnessed or knew something about the assassination of John Kennedy ended up very dead.
It's 115 that I tried to track down to interview when I was working on the Killzone book. And some of them died of what you might call natural causes, but in my opinion, there's no such thing as natural causes. Everybody dies from something. But there's a lot of them that committed suicide just before they were to testify before one of the three major investigations into the assassination. There's some that were mysteriously murdered. Just all kinds of them that you read each case, you find out who they were, what they had to do with the assassination, what they knew about, and then what happened to them afterwards. So it's kind of a good research book, and it makes for some interesting reading on some of these characters.
It really is, and I think, Chris, you did a great job on that. And then, of course, Craig has written the Medusa File. He's written Killzone. He's written, co-authored the Gateway to Hell. We think they're all excellent books, and of course, if you want to know more about them, why, you can either get in touch with Craig or you can call our 800 number, 1-800-544-8927. Well, Craig, thanks very much for being with us, and we're just going to have to keep an eye on what's going on, but I really feel that God is going to bring his judgment on this nation unless there is a great revival. Let's just hope and pray it comes.
Well, I think it's happening right now if we just watch what's happening around us.
God bless. Well, thank you so very much for being with us, Craig. It's always a pleasure.
We'll see you next time.
All right. Good night.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, that was Craig Roberts and, of course, Rifleman.com. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and, of course, this is the time I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener supported. We're dependent on those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out 5 hours a day to try to make people understand we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. So if you agree with us and you'd like to help us, as we are certainly on internet 5 hours a day and radio someplace in America 5 hours a day, and on the shortwave 4 hours a day, on satellite 5 hours a day. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, The Occult Hierarchy, and I suggest The Occult Hierarchy Part 2, it's the June Radio Liberty letter. Now you can go up on our internet site at www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com, and you can pull down our newsletters, and we give you our permission to pull them down and copy them and certainly distribute them. But if you'd like a free copy of the June newsletter, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and we'll get your copy. And we do hope, of course, that you'll tell others about our program, encourage them to listen on a regular basis. And we do want to mention that we are going to have, again this year, as we have for a number of years in the past, an all-day seminar on the 19th of November of this year. That's the week before Thanksgiving. It's going to be its all-day Saturday, and it's right here in the Monterey Bay area at the Sea Cliff Inn. And so if you'd be interested in coming, and of course it would be lunch, why, I suggest you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. That's the all-day seminar on the 19th of November, and we do hope that many of you will be able to come and bring your friends, as we've got a great lineup of speakers right now, and we're going to try to bring you up abreast of what's really going on and try to educate you as to the things that you can do to reach other people, to make them understand that there is today in the United States a conspiracy against God. And if you doubt that, you can read it. You can go to the Bible, the Scriptures, and read Jeremiah 11:9. That's Jeremiah 11:9. Ezekiel 22:25, the second Psalm. And there's always been a conspiracy against God, and it's certainly effective. It's in full force. It is being waged here in America today. That's, of course, why the Supreme Court has taken God and prayer and the Ten Commandments out of our schools. And that is why, of course, they don't want to teach our young people the Declaration of Independence, because it talks about the Creator, that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. And some of our textbooks even take that word, the Creator, out of the Declaration of Independence, because the last thing they want is for our children to learn the truth. So we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers, but we ask you to remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, because we're on the front lines of this battle. So remember our number, 1-800-544-8927, our website, www.radioliberty.com. Until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you. And as St. Paul admonished us, put on the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore, take unto you the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to withstand in the evil days, and having done all, to stand. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views and the views of our guests. And today our guest is William Federer, certainly one of my favorite guests as always. Thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Well, it's great to be with you, Dr. Stan.
And we were going to have you tell the Thanksgiving story this evening, so I'm going to let you just take off and tell us the background of Thanksgiving, which is so poorly understood today. I mean, Thanksgiving has to be with turkey, and Thanksgiving has to do with football, and Thanksgiving has to do with a lot of things that, well, it really doesn't have to do with, because, of course, this was a very, very special time at one time in our country when we gave thanks not to the Indians who would help the pilgrims, we gave thanks to God. So pick up the story.
Well, it goes back to the situation in Europe. During the Middle Ages, there was the philosophy that whatever the king believed, the kingdom had to believe. And for a large part of European history, the Catholic Church controlled most of Europe. And then later when the Reformation happened, the kings would adopt a state denomination. And so in England, it was Anglican. In Germany, it was Lutheran. Switzerland was Calvinist. Italy, Spain, and France was Roman Catholic. Greece and Russia, Eastern Orthodox. Scotland, Presbyterian. And if you didn't believe the way the king did, you were persecuted and you fled. And a little background in England. Henry VIII is the one who brought the Reformation to England, but not because he had any spiritual experience. It was because he wanted another wife. And I always thought, well, Henry VIII, he must have had 8 wives. No, he only had 6, believe it or not. His first wife was Catherine of Aragon. And she was the daughter of King Ferdinand and Isabel of Spain, the ones who sent Columbus to America. Well, after 18 years, Catherine didn't have a child, so Henry decided to divorce her. The Pope said no, and Henry said, the heck with you, I'll be my own Pope. So he started the Church of England, put himself on as the head, and went on to have 6 wives, as I said. Their fates, unfortunately, were divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. So Henry was not a really nice guy to be married to. Anyway, his advisor suggested that to solidify his break with Rome, you know, the Roman Catholic Church, that Henry should stop using the Latin Bible in the Church of England and instead have an English Bible, which was sort of ironic because just a few years earlier, Henry VIII had William Tyndale killed, who was a translator of the Bible. Anyway, for political reasons mostly, Henry VIII spread the English Bible around the country, thinking that this would solidify his break with Rome. But something unexpected happened. People began to read the Bible and began to want to purify the Church of England. The king, obviously, who was the head of the church, didn't think he needed any purifying, so he persecuted this group. Obviously, if they were trying to purify it, they were nicknamed the Puritans. Well, the king got an archbishop named William Laud, L-A-U-D, who composed a list of all the leaders in England, and he put an O or a P by their name, O for Orthodox and P for Puritan, and all the Puritans lost their jobs. They were purged from academia. They could no longer teach at Oxford or Cambridge, and they basically became second-class citizens. William Laud even had spies to go into the churches and sit there during the church services and to see whether or not the pastors were following the liturgy. And so we saw that there was another group that said they weren't even going to bother trying to purify the Church of England.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment.
Okay.
Well, our guest, William Federer, and he's talking about how the Puritan movement came about and how that part of the Puritans, of course, were made second-class citizens under Henry VIII. But there was another group that said, we're not even going to try to purify this this corrupt society. So pick up the story there, Bill.
Well, that group was the separatists. They met in secret and in barns and basements, and sort of like the illegal house churches in China that we are seeing today. And when they were captured, these separatists would get branded on the face as a heretic, or maybe get an ear cut off or disfigured. They would be put in prison. There were several stories that William Bradford writes about in his History of the Plymouth Settlement. William Bradford says that one group of these separatists decided to go to Holland because there was some semblance of religious freedom in Holland, but these people sold their goods and bought passage on a ship. And the captain of the ship, before he set sail, went and held them at gunpoint and robbed them and turned them over to the officials, and they were thrown in jail, and the captain got to keep all their stuff. Another group of these separatists sold their farms and all their belongings and had a Dutch ship meet them on another coast of England, but not at the main port, and the men were busy ferrying out all their goods to put on the ship. And while they were loading them onto the ship, the British came over the hill and captured the women and children. And the captain of the Dutch ship decided to pull anchor and sail away because he didn't want to get caught, obviously. And you can just imagine the heartbreak of these women on the shore with their little ones, and their husbands are sailing away. And, of course, the husbands are on deck saying, but my wife and kids. And what happened was that these women and children were passed from one judge to another judge to another judge for over 2 years. And finally, one of the judges says, you didn't really commit any crime. You were just wanting to be with your husband. So that's not a crime. So we're not going to keep you in prison so you can go ahead and go home. And they said, well, we can't go home. We sold our homes. We don't have any homes. And so after a little while later, the British decided to put the women and the children on a ship and send them over to Holland to be reunited with their husband. So there was a happy ending to that episode. But anyway, the Dutch received these separatists, and 12 years went by, and William Bradford and William Brewster, several of the Puritan leaders.
You're going to have to hold that thought, William. We'll be back in just a moment as we bring our other stations on board. Well, yeah, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Federer, and we're telling the story of Thanksgiving. And so the separatist families, the Christian families, were reunited in Holland. And, of course, at least here, there is an element of religious tolerance. They've gotten away from England. They've left Great Britain because, of course, the cruel and ruthless persecution of the Puritans, those who believed in the gospel and would not accept, of course, a corrupted gospel, which was the gospel that was approved by the centralized government of Henry VIII. So pick up the story there.
As a matter of fact, here is an excerpt from Bradford's History of the Plymouth Settlement. He says, it is well known unto ye godly and judicious, how since ye first breaking out of ye light of ye gospel in our honorable nation of England, which was the first of the nations whom the Lord adorned therewith after the gross darkness which had covered and overspread the Christian world, what wars and oppositions ever since, Satan hath raised, maintained, and continued against the saints from time to time in one sort or another, sometimes by bloody death and cruel torments, others while imprisonments, banishments, and other harsh usages, as being loath, his kingdom go down, and truth prevaileth, and ye churches of God revert to their ancient purity and recover their primitive order, liberty, and beauty. And of course, this is written in the Old English, so I'm sort of modernizing it here. But it says, but when he could not prevail by these means against the main truth of the gospel, but that they were beginning to take root in many places, being watered by the blood of the martyrs and blessed from heaven with a gracious increase, he then began to take some of his ancient stratagems against the first Christians. But then, when bloody and barbarous persecutions of heathen emperors, he could not stop or subvert the course of the gospel, but it speedily overspread with a wonderful celerity over the parts. Anyway, so William Bradford is making a pretty clear statement that if faith is the reason that they left England. that the same Satan that persecuted the Christians of old were persecuting them, and so they fled, and they fled to Holland. They lived there 12 years, and but they began to see their children being assimilated into the Dutch culture, learning the Dutch language, going to the Dutch schools, and they realized that they were going to be a one-generation movement, that they weren't getting any other people coming over from England, and so they were just pretty much on their own, a few hundred of them. Then they decided to go to the New World. They first were going to go to British Guyana, which was in South America, but they heard horror stories of what the Spaniards would do. There was actually a settlement of French Protestants called Huguenots in Florida, by Jacksonville, Florida, when the Fort Caroline was the name of it, and the Spaniards heard about this French settlement and were going to attack it. So they landed south of the Jacksonville area and began unloading their troops and building their fort and making preparations to attack. And the French decided they were going to do a little preemptive attack. So they got all their ships and all their soldiers and all their sailors, and they left Fort Caroline and were going down the Florida coast when, guess what, a hurricane hit. And we just experienced a terrible hurricane, and there's many of them over the years have hit Florida as well as Louisiana. But anyway, this hurricane smashed the French fleet and so decimated it. Some of the soldiers, sailors made it ashore, and the Spaniards came up the beach and captured them. When they got to Fort Caroline, they all the people that were left, about 300 of them, were in the fort. And they did have arms, and they were ready to defend themselves, but the French received the message from the Spaniards that if they surrendered, they would get safe passage to another area. So the French surrendered, and then the Spaniards said, well, you know, we don't have to keep faith with the heretic. And they obviously thought that since they were the Protestants, they were heretics, and they didn't have to keep their word to them. So they took them, all the men, to the riverbank and cut off their heads, over 300 of them. And then the women and children they made, you know, they took captive. And that ended the French claim to the New World. But stories like this had filtered back to these pilgrims. Again, that was 1565, and we're talking about 1609. And so these pilgrims decided, these separatists decided that they do not want to go anywhere near Spain's area, where Spain controlled the Caribbean. They called it the Spanish Main. That was the area of the sea controlled by Spain. So the pilgrims decided to go to Jamestown, which was started there in Virginia. It was more or less a business venture. It had gotten a lot of Indian problems. You know, that's where John Smith was, and they had the fights with the Indians, and, of course, Pocahontas. Now, Pocahontas did not marry John Smith. She married John Rolfe, who was a tobacco farmer, but he was a Christian, and she was baptized, took the name Rebecca. Pocahontas actually came to Britain and was treated as royalty there, and then she caught an illness and died, and she left a son named Thomas. Thomas grew up in England and then later came back and joined the colonies, and Thomas's descendants include Edith Bowling Galt, who married President Woodrow Wilson. So Woodrow Wilson's wife was a descendant of Pocahontas. But the story goes on that the Virginia settlement of Jamestown, that's where they grew tobacco, that's where they had the first slaves in America. It was doing so poorly because it was built in an area that was not well irrigated, that they were going to leave the settlement. At one point, they even got to the place where they were starving and there were reports of cannibalism. That people that died, freshly died, they cut them up and ate them, you know. But they were eating the leather from their boots and the leather from their belts, and they decided to torch the city and leave. So as they were packing up all their stuff on a ship, and they were about ready to set fire to Jamestown, they looked, and in the harbor was pulling in another ship full of fresh supplies from England. And it had a new commander in it, and this new commander took charge and brought order to the colony, and so Jamestown did continue. But these stories also filtered back to these pilgrims, and so they were it was a risk for them to come to the New World. But luckily they got blown off course and did not land at Jamestown, and that's a little further into the story. But back in Holland, these Dutch, or these separatists, apply to the king for permission to come to the New World, which was quite a challenge because the king didn't like them because they didn't acknowledge the king as the head of the church. But they finally got permission, and they got a ship named the Speedwell. Unfortunately, the Speedwell did not speed well. Just a short time out into the ocean, it began leaking. Some reports were that the captain did not want to go on this trip to the New World and stressed the sails on purpose so that the seams of the boat would separate and begin leaking, and that was his excuse to go back. But nevertheless, the pilgrims switched their goods to the Mayflower, and they took off toward the New World. But unfortunately, they had wasted a good month of sailing weather. So now they were departing late in the season, and so there were more storms in the North Atlantic. The pilgrims were in the between deck, a four-foot space, and if you can remember, imagine for over a month being confined in a four-foot-high place with no windows, and 102 pilgrims, and you can imagine babies crying. You know, one baby was born on the trip, and of course you can imagine the stench and the noise. And there was a storm. They were in a storm most of the way, and they were tossing and turning, and at one point the main beam that held up the mast cracked, and one of the pilgrims had a printer's press of screw, and they stuck it underneath and screwed it back into place from underneath, bracing it. One of the pilgrims was so exasperated by being under the deck for this long and the smell and the noise that he went topside just as a freezing North Atlantic wave was sweeping the deck, and it knocked him overboard, and his arm caught a rope, and luckily they pulled him back into the boat, and he was frozen blue, but he survived, and he never went topside again. Anyway, they got blown off course because of this terrible storm, and they landed at Cape Cod. They tried coming back out and going down the coast, but the breakers were too strong, is what William Bradford writes. So this being November, they decided that it was time to begin to make preparation for the winter, so they were going to set their settlement there at Cape Cod, at Plymouth Rock. William Bradford said before they went ashore, they realized that they would not be under the Virginia Charter. So they sort of had to come up with their own law. And they decided to write the Mayflower Compact, which was the first governmental document written in the New World. And it's unique because it's a mutual covenanting together of people under God. And it says, we the hereby undersigned, starts off in the name of God, amen, we the hereby undersigned, for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith, set forth to plant a colony on the northern parts of Virginia. And it says that solemnly and mutually in the presence of God and one another covenant and combine ourselves together into a civil body politic for the better ordering and preserving and furtherance of ye ends aforesaid. So they voluntarily form themselves into a civil body politic under God, and that's the basic foundation outline for our U.S. Constitution. The pilgrims went ashore, and they didn't find anybody there, which was a blessing, and I'll tell you why in just a minute.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment with William Federer and the Thanksgiving story, the story of the pilgrims going to the New World, landing at Plymouth, and we'll be back to tell you the rest of the story. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and so the pilgrims arrive there. They go ashore at Plymouth, and there's nobody there. They're sort of a little afraid there might be Indians there. And so tell us what happened at that point.
Well, William Bradford writes in his History of the Plymouth Settlement that just 3 months before the Pilgrims landed, that a French ship had been shipwrecked right there at Cape Cod. And the sailors got ashore, but it says here, this is a direct quote, it says, about 3 years before, a French ship was wrecked at Cape Cod, but the men got ashore and saved their lives and a large part of their provisions. When the Indians heard of it, they surrounded them and never left watching and dogging them till they got the advantage, and killed them all but three or four, whom they kept and sent from one sachem to another, making sport with them and using them worse than slaves. And some of the things, stories that were passed down to us from the Jesuit missionaries, you know, with the Spaniards, had been in North America from, you know, Christopher Columbus on. Christopher Columbus came across in 1492, so the 1500s was basically, the settlements. Santa Fe, New Mexico, was the first settlement in North America, and then, of course, all up and down California, and then the French priests came down from Canada. But some of the stories that happened, one in particular, where the priest was there and captured by the Indians, and they tied him up to a post, and they gnawed the meat off his fingers right in front of him. Can you imagine the horror of that? And then this priest was made to beg like a dog and grovel on the ground. And one winter, when all the Indians were in their huts and he was forced to stay outside, he ran and escaped. And after weeks and weeks, he finally found the shore again, then finally found passage back to Europe. And the Pope actually kissed his gnarled up fingers. And then several years later, he decided he was called back to America to witness to the Indians, and of course he eventually was killed by the Indians. But those were stories, and similar ones like that, that were that these pilgrims had heard of the New World. So you can imagine, if you and I were to take a trip to the deepest, darkest part of Africa, or you know, the Amazon River with piranhas and electric eels, and you know, it took a lot of faith and courage for these pilgrims to come over. Anyway, I said the French ship was landed there, and the Indians killed all of the sailors except three or four of them. And you think, boy, why did they do that? Well, the eastern seaboard of America had some of the most violent Indian tribes. Part of it was justified because the European sailors, whether it was French or Dutch or English, many times would lure natives onto their ships and enslave them and teach them their language so the Indians could show them the good fishing spots and so on and so forth. And then sometimes they'd take them to Malaga, Spain, which was the big slave trading port, and they would sell the Indians. So the Indians did not like the Europeans. But lo and behold, the Pilgrims land right there at Cape Cod. But what happened to that violent tribe? A illness had swept through that area. It could have been from those sailors, because the Indians' immune system was not used to defending against smallpox and so forth. But so great was this devastation that no other Indian tribe even attempted to take over that land. So the Pilgrims
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back. Well, William Vedder is telling us the story of the first Thanksgiving, and of course what had happened is the pilgrims had landed, and there were no Indians there. And the reason there were no Indians is because there had been a French ship there 3 years before, and the Indians had killed just about all the Frenchmen other than three or four of them who they treated as slaves. But the Indians had caught a disease from the Frenchmen, and now the whole Indian tribe was wiped out. So there were no Indians in this one specific area, and all of the Indians from the surrounding tribes were afraid to come into that area. They probably felt it was cursed, or the Indians were very, very superstitious. So suddenly the pilgrims land in the one place all along the eastern seaboard where there are no Indians there. They don't have to worry about fighting the Indians. They're struggling to make their landing, and it's almost as if God had preordained, created this storm to blow them off course away from Jamestown, and now they have a place. At least they have the ability to begin to build their and make preparations for the winter, where they're not going to have to be fighting for their lives, as it happened with the previous French sailors that landed, and of course they were mostly killed. So pick up the story there with him.
So the pilgrims landed, but by now it's late in the year. It's November 20th is when they signed the Mayflower Compact, and they got offshore. They found a couple iron pots of corn that the Indians prior had stashed underground, and they found it, and that helped them. And but they couldn't plant anything, and they were running low, so the men got out and started chopping wood and building shelters. And they would get sweaty, and they would keep working, and the sweat would turn into a cold, and they would keep working, and then the cold would turn into pneumonia, and they'd keep working, and then they would die. And then sometimes one a day, two a day, three a day, four a day, five. Over half of the pilgrims died that very first winter. At one point, only two pilgrims were standing, and William Brewster was one of them, and Captain Miles Standish was the other, and they would bury the dead at nighttime because they didn't know if any Indians were watching. They didn't want the Indians to know how weak they were. And then in the morning, they would march the palisades and maybe even fire off some of their guns to make a noise, to maybe scare away. And they would nurse the other ones back to health and, you know, give them soup and what little food they had. One of the times, there was the incident of their main meeting house where they had people and sick, you know, and the children. They had their gunpowder stored there. Well, the house caught on fire, and the fire spread, and fiery beams fell very near close to the barrels of gunpowder. And had they, of course, landed on the gunpowder, it would have blown the Pilgrim settlement sky high, and we wouldn't have them. But miraculously, they were fine. But at the end of that winter, the Pilgrims realized that it was such a harsh environment. Only five couples retained their original spouses. I mean, after that winter was over, the widows would marry the widowers, and they sort of, you know, patched together their families. But they realized they were not going to be able to make it. And then one of the most interesting miracles in American history came about. And this is what William Bradford wrote. And he said, about the 16th of March, 1621, a certain Indian came boldly amongst them and spoke to them in broken English. His name was Samoset. He told them of another Indian whose name was Squanto, a native of this place who had been in England and could speak English better than himself. About 4 or 5 days after came the aforesaid Squanto. He continued with them and was their interpreter and a special instrument sent of God for their good beyond their expectation. He showed them how to plant corn, where to take fish, and other commodities. He guided them to unknown places and never left them till he died. It goes on to say, he was a native of these parts and had been one of the few survivors of a plague hereabouts. He was carried away with others by one Hunt, a captain of a ship who intended to sell them for slaves in Spain. But he got away for England and was received by a merchant in London and employed in Newfoundland and other parts, and lastly brought to these parts by a Captain Dermer. Now, if you can imagine the life that this Squanto had, evidently he was one of those Indians that was lured onto a boat and taken to Spain and sold as a slave, and he got free. Could you imagine seeing this Indian hitchhiking across Europe and you know, 1609 or whatever, found his way back to England and learned the English language, worked there, was employed by one of the fishing companies. And after several years, he finally is persuaded a Captain Dermer to drop him back off in America on the coast of the, you know, Cape Cod. And when he gets off the boat, he finds that all of his tribe is dead. Now, you can imagine how depressed he would be to think, gee, all my life I wanted to come back home, and now home's, everybody's dead. But God had a plan, and that plan was to rescue the pilgrim.
that teach them. Go ahead, William.
Oh, okay. I was speaking, and then I heard the music come in, so I decided to break.
Right, go ahead.
But I'll pick up then. You may need to do some editing when you are about to play this back. But anyway, so Squanto was kidnapped, taken to Spain, sold as a slave. The story is he was purchased by some monks, found his way back to England, and after about 9 years, came back to the New World, only to find that all of his family and relatives had died in that plague. And the story is that he went to live with another tribe, and you can imagine how dejected he would have felt all of his life, wanting to get back home, and only come home to find that all of his family is dead. But then he's living with this other tribe for about 6 months through the winter time, and in the spring, his friend Samoset comes into his teepee, and I can imagine the conversation. You know, hey Squant, you wouldn't believe it. There's a bunch of English people trying to start a settlement on your old native ground, and so Squanto goes to them and finds them woefully inept. He decides to teach them all about the land, because he grew up there. He knew where the springs of water were. He would take the young men down to the riverbank and have them take off their shoes and, you know, squeegee in the mud and catch eels, and they would eat the eels. And he taught them how to catch fish, and they, of course, they had tried to catch fish, but he said the spawning season was coming up, and that they should get their nets ready, and they were going to harvest the fish. There were going to be so many, and sure enough, that happened. And then he showed them how to plant corn, and they said, well, we tried doing that. And he said, well, you put the kernel of corn down, and then you take some of the dead fish and lay them on top of the corn, and you guard it for about 3 or 4 weeks until the fish decompose, you know, to keep the wolves away from taking the fish, and that the dying fish will fertilize the soil. And they had an abundant harvest that year. And Squanto thought...
Hold that stuff right there. Okay, this is Dr. Stan. Go ahead, William.
And Squanto taught the pilgrims how to take the corn and shake it over a fire and make popcorn. He taught them how to trade with the Indians. Since he knew the Indian languages and he knew how to speak English, he was the ideal interpreter. Squanto, and one of the most important things, is he taught them how to catch beaver. And the beaver skins is what these pilgrims used to pay off their debt to the adventurer, that's what they call the investor, who financed their trip to the New World. You know, we always see the pilgrims in a boat, but we never ask ourselves the question, who is paying for this boat ride? Well, the pilgrims went in debt. It took them 40 years worth of beaver skins to pay off that boat ride. At one point, they had the person they owed the money to came to the New World, and he was out of favor with the rest of his, you know, investment company, and so the pilgrims gave him a whole boatload of beaver skins, and he went and basically squandered it, and it did not go toward the paying off of their debt. But it seems like, you know, the Lord's people are always in debt, but that's no excuse not to do anything for the Lord. So Squanto was their interpreter, and several other stories in the book about how one of the Indian tribes tried to kill Squanto, and then the soldiers, you know, with Captain Miles Standish, were about to go and try to attack the Indian tribe, and, you know, and then they found out that Squanto wasn't killed, but they tried to kill him, but he escaped, and, you know, a lot of fascinating stuff. And of course, it's all in the book, William Bradford's History of the Plymouth Settlement. And just to give you a little bit of a timeline, William Bradford was basically a contemporary of William Shakespeare. So while William Shakespeare is over in England writing his plays, William Bradford and the Pilgrims are in America writing history, living the history. And Squanto did such a good job at putting them on good terms with the other Indian tribes, and he taught them how to plant corn so well that November of the 1621, they had a great harvest, so they invited the Indians to come for a Thanksgiving feast. And yes, they did thank God. It was a tradition that they had that basically turned into the American tradition that we have today. And the pilgrims were always thanking God, and you read through the history of the Plymouth Settlement, you'll see Like, here's one place William Bradford wrote, "Last and not least, they cherished a great hope and an inward zeal of laying good foundations, or at least making some way towards it, for the propagation and advancement of the gospel of the kingdom of Christ in the remote parts of the world, even though they should be but stepping stones to others in the performance of so great a work." And it says, "Thus out of small beginnings, greater things have been produced by his hand that has made all things out of nothing and gives being to all that are. And as one small candle may light a thousand, so the light here kindleth hath shone unto many, yea, in some sort to the whole nation. Let the glorious name of Jehovah have all the praise." So, boy, you can see from William Bradford's writings that he was definitely a strong Christian. William Bradford, by the way, was elected the governor of the Plymouth Colony 30 years, and he took off a couple years, and then they elected him back again to be the governor of the colony. His wife died right when they came over, so he basically lived for the people there. But the first Thanksgiving, the Indians brought turkey and deer, and of course the pilgrims supplied the goods that they had cooked and the puddings and so forth. At the end of the day, the Indians just rolled up in their blankets and their furs and slept on the ground, and the next day the Indians kept the Thanksgiving party going again. And then that happened the third day, so the first Thanksgiving went on for 3 days. And you can imagine, that first they'd be afraid they would go through all their supplies for the winter. Well, they had plenty of supplies because the Indians were brought their food. But shortly thereafter, another boatload of pilgrims arrived. Well, when their boat's in the harbor, these ones that are here think, oh, great, we got more supplies. Well, when the boat comes off and the people unload, they find out that they did not bring any supplies with them. So what these pilgrims had saved for an abundance for their winter, they now had to ration. And so the second winter was almost as bad as the first. It got to the place where at one point they had to ration 5 kernels of corn a day per person. You can imagine, they called it the starving time. And but then that next spring, they began to plant again. One story that I think is worth noting, it's the first attempt in America at communism and then at capitalism. At first, William Bradford had everybody that could to get out in the field and plant corn. Well, guess what? Everybody was sick. Nobody wanted to go out and plant. The women were nursing their kids, and so it flopped. They didn't have any planting, and they didn't have a big harvest. But the next year, William Bradford said, look, everybody gets their own plot of land, and whatever you grow on your plot, you get to keep. And guess what? Every sick person was out there dragging, every mom had her little kid on her side, and she was out there planting, and they had a tremendous harvest. And so the first experiment at communism failed, and the second one on capitalism, where you got to own the work of your hand, that prospered. But after 10 years of the pilgrims being in the New World, the Puritans, and they were the ones that were trying to purify the Church of England, they had gotten more opposition, and it was so heated in England that it was brewing toward a civil war. And that's when John Winthrop decided that if the pilgrims, this little band, could survive for 10 years in the New World, because they came across 1620 and this was now about 1630, so that John Winthrop said the Puritans could make it too. So 20,000 Puritans left England, and they call it the Great Migration in history books, and they settled in Massachusetts. They estimate a fifth of the wealth of England fled and settled in Massachusetts. And now they had this dilemma because they were part of the Church of England, which had the king as their head, but it was a three-month, turnaround if you needed an answer to a question. So basically, these Puritans said, we need some form of self-government because we can't be waiting 3 months every time we have a question. And so they looked toward the pilgrims to see, how did you organize your self-governing plantation? And so the Pilgrims laid the example for the Puritans, and then the Puritans laid the example for, you know, the other colonies, and in particular Connecticut, which came to be known as the Constitution State. Thomas Hooker was a Congregationalist minister, and he preached a sermon on how we have individual rights because they came from God, that we're equal before God, therefore we're equal before men, therefore everybody gets one equal vote. You know, you don't have somebody's vote being more important than somebody else's vote. He talked about the rights of conscience and all these different parts that have... And what happened was, after his sermon, several of the men sat down and wrote out his sermon, and out of it came the fundamental constitutions of Connecticut, which became their state constitution. And the Connecticut Constitution was the blueprint for the U.S. Constitution. If you've ever traveled and seen the license plate for the state of Connecticut, what does it say? It says the Constitution State. And so you can very clearly have a line from the U.S. Constitution, a voluntary submitting of we the people one unto another, and it ends, done in the year of our Lord, 1787. But from the U.S. Constitution goes back to the Connecticut Constitution, which draws the line to the Puritans, which draws the line to the Pilgrims, to the Mayflower Compact. So we can see the country was founded not by the war or conquest, but the great contribution was this voluntary submitting of one another to the Lord in a covenant. Anyway, the Pilgrims celebrated Thanksgiving, and it became a tradition which spread across the country. It was George Washington that gave the first national day of Thanksgiving, and of course he was the first president of us as a United Nation. Prior to then, individual colonies would have many proclamations of Thanksgiving, but George Washington wrote this October 3rd, 1789. He says, "Whereas it is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly to implore His protection and favor, now, therefore, I do recommend and assign Thursday, the 26th, the day of November next, to be devoted by the people of these United States as a day of Thanksgiving." And then at the end of his reign as president, George Washington issued another day of Thanksgiving. And he says, "It is in a special manner our duty as a people, with devout reverence and affectionate gratitude, to acknowledge our many and great obligations to Almighty God, and to implore Him to continue and confirm the blessings we experienced." And, deeply penetrated with the sentiment, "I, George Washington, President of the United States, do recommend all religious societies and denominations, and to all persons, whosoever, within the United States, to set apart and observe Thursday, the 19th of February, next, as a day of public Thanksgiving, and on that day to meet together and render sincere thanks to the great ruler of the nations for the manifold and signal mercies of which distinguished our lot as a nation." And then many other presidents declared days of Thanksgiving between then and Abraham Lincoln. And Lincoln was the one who made it an annual event. So every president from Abraham Lincoln until now has issued an annual national day of Thanksgiving to Almighty God, not to the Indians. Now, we do thank the thankful to the Indians, but these Thanksgiving proclamations were to God. Here's Lincoln's October 3rd, 1863, Thanksgiving Proclamation. It says, "No human counsel has devised, nor hath any mortal hand worked out these great things. They are the gracious gifts of the Most High God, who, while dealing with us in anger for our sins, hath nevertheless remembered mercy. I do therefore invite my fellow citizens in every part of the United States, and those who are sojourning in foreign lands, to set apart and observe Thursday of November next as a day of thanksgiving and praise to our beneficent Father who dwelleth in the heavens. It is announced in the Holy Scriptures and proven by all history that those nations are blessed whose God is the Lord." Again, this sounds like a church sermon, but that was President Abraham Lincoln. And, matter of fact, in 1864, in his second annual Thanksgiving proclamation, Lincoln said, "And I do further recommend to my fellow citizens that on that occasion they do reverently humble themselves in the dust, and from thence offer up penitent and fervent prayers and supplications to the great disposer of events for a return of the inestimable blessing of peace, union, and harmony throughout the land, which it has pleased him to assign as a dwelling place for ourselves and our posterity. Again, a very strong call to prayer that we humble ourselves in the dust. This is a call by Abraham Lincoln in 1864. But another little interesting bit of trivia, Dr. Stan, is Franklin Roosevelt during the Depression in like 1939 decided to change the date of Thanksgiving. Just as today, back then, the shopping season before Christmas started the day after Thanksgiving. So Franklin Roosevelt thought if he could move Thanksgiving up a week, then we would have an extra week of shopping before Christmas, and therefore it might help jumpstart the economy out of the Depression. Well, it got to the place where he did change it, but some of the states wanted to stick with the traditional last Thursday of November, and some of the other states went with this new third Thursday of November. And it's interesting that the Democrat states went with FDR and the Republican states stayed with the original date. Some states like Texas celebrated both Thursdays as, you know, two Thanksgivings. And up east, where several of the states were close together, that people would be celebrating, you know, in one area, one Thanksgiving, one area, and this went on for 2 years, and it got to be a political item, so much so that when FDR ran for re-election, his Republican opponent made it a platform issue that he was going to return Thanksgiving back to its original date, but before that happened, FDR acquiesced, and he changed the date, partly because he saw that the finances of shopping did not dramatically change because of it, and so he moved it back to the original date. And unfortunately, a week later, Pearl Harbor was bombed, and the World War II started for the Americans. But some interesting history with Thanksgiving, and again, every president from Abraham Lincoln until today has issued a national day of Thanksgiving to Almighty God, and that's one of the issues that always concerns me, is that here we have this fine and long-standing tradition of acknowledging God and thanking God, and just within the last generation we've seen the birth of this ACLU and secular humanism and the atheists who are wanting to do everything they can to remove these acknowledgments of God, and it's a very un-American effort on their behalf, and I mean that in all sincerity, because if American is lining up with American history, we have all of the history that I just mentioned, which does acknowledge God, and we see this recent effort to remove it. And of course, listening to your program, Dr. Stan, most people are aware that the ACLU was started by Roger Baldwin, who was a Communist Party member. And the ACLU was first designed, you know, put together to defend Nazis and communists. And so only after World War II did they try to refurbish, you know, reinvent their image as not quite as, you know, revolutionary. But nevertheless, they're still promoting that same anti-God agenda that Roger Baldwin did at their very beginning. But Thanksgiving is a wonderful time with a wonderful history. You know, and even the story of Squanto and the miracle of God's provision by having this Indian who had the tragedy of being kidnapped and being away from home, but he was such a blessing because he had known the English language. Matter of fact, one of the things I really think is interesting was what Squanto said before he died. And William Bradford writes about how they were traveling in the bay there, and they had got caught in a storm, and the ship had to be put ashore on an island. And when they landed, the rain was so cold that Squanto caught ill and eventually died. And this is the story that He says Squanter was their guide and their interpreter, but about the latter end of September, the winds drove them in, and putting them there in again, Captain Standish fell ill with fever, so the governor went with him. They could not get around the shoals of Cape Cod for the flats and breakers, so Squanto could not direct them better.
Hold that thought.
The captain of the boat dare not go further, so he put into Manamoyac Bay, where they got there. And it says, just a short little bit left, here Squanto fell ill of Indian fever, bleeding much at the nose, which the Indians take for a symptom of death, and he died within a few days. He begged the governor to pray for him, that he might go to the Englishman's God in heaven. And he bequeathed several of his things to some of his English friends and remembrances. His death was a great loss. So here we have Squanto, in his dying words, was he begged the governor to pray for him that he might go to the Englishman's God in heaven. And the Englishman's God obviously was the our God, the Judeo-Christian God. And I can't help but think that with a faith and a desire like that, that Squanto did go to heaven, and he's up there. So fascinating history. And of course, Dr. Stan, I've put all this in my different books, but my main book is America's God and Country Encyclopedia of Quotations. America's God and Country Encyclopedia of Quotations, which is a big 845-page reference book of God and Country quotes and stories and chapters of famous people that influenced American history. And would love to make it available to your listeners, and just appreciate the opportunity to share the Thanksgiving story with your tremendous listening audience.
Well, I want you, first of all, to give your website so people can know how to get in touch with you, or do you have an 800 number?
Our website is AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com, and if anyone's interested, we send out a free daily email called An American Minute. And you sign up for it; it comes in your email box, and then also we have a toll free number. It's 1-888-USA-WORD, 1-888-USA-WORD. But again, if any are listening and desire to purchase any of my books, you can always get it through Dr. Stan and Radio Liberty, and we'll be glad to get it to you right away.
All right, fine. Well, I want to thank you so very much. Our guest has been William Federer, and William has written a wonderful book, America's God and Country, and all sorts of other books, one on St. Nicholas and one on George Washington Carver, and let's see, there's one more we haven't mentioned.
St. Patrick. One on President's Day, the Treasury of Presidential Quotations, and then my new book, Backfire, The Nation Born for Religious Tolerance No Longer Tolerates Religion.
That's right. In fact, we think this is a very important book as well. Well, William, thank you so very much for being with us, and we'll be talking to you again real soon. But I hope your message, and we're going to be playing this on Thanksgiving as well as tonight, I hope this will rekindle the realization that we give thanks to God for our freedom. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and before I let William Federer go, William, first of all, William was telling us the story of Squanto, and Squanto dies as a result of being exposed, but before he dies, he asked for them to pray that he will go to the white man's heaven. He is, of course, certainly seen their lives, seen how it impacts on their interpersonal relationships, and even though he's an Indian, he of course asked for them to pray for him and his salvation. So it's a wonderful, wonderful story, and of course so much of this is told in William's books, America's God and Country, and his other books on Saint Nicholas and on George Washington Carver, and if you'd like to give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, why we'll be glad to send you a list of other various books he's published. But before we let you go, William, would you put out your website and telephone number if people would like to get in touch with you?
Oh, thanks, Dr. Stan. It's 1-888-USA-WORD. That's 1-888-USA-WORD. And the website is www.AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com. And once again, I sent out a free daily email called American Minute. It's actually a radio spot, airs on several hundred radio stations, but I send it out free as a text, as email. And so you can get it and see what happened on that day in American history.
And one of our listeners called in and asked if you'd just repeat Squanto's deathbed request.
Yeah, this is on page 110 of William Bradford's History of the Plymouth Settlement. And, of course, I have this in my American Quotations CD-ROM. But it says, "Here Squanto fell ill of Indian fever, bleeding much at the nose, which the Indians take for a symptom of death. And within a few days he died. He begged the governor to pray for him that he might go to the Englishman's God in heaven. And he bequeathed several of his things to some of his English friends as remembrances. His death was a great loss." And that was William Bradford's History of the Plymouth Settlement, which was printed back in 1646. So fabulous book that this is. But in another place, you know, William Bradford says, "Squanto was a special instrument sent of God for their good beyond their expectation." And so it's neat how what was a tragedy for this Indian not only turned to his good by, you know, salvation, but it turned to the good of all these pilgrims that were dying on the, you know, the dangerous wild area with 3,000 miles away from their home in England.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us. And Thanksgiving was thanks to God for their preservation. God bless you. Good night. And have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, fine. That was William Federer, and I hope you enjoyed the story. And we'll be playing this every Thanksgiving because I think it's such an important issue. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like one of our free newsletters, just give us a call. And, of course, please go to our website at www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And please pray for America, pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And as William Tocqueville wrote, Tocqueville had come to America in the late 1830s, to find out what the secret was of our country. And this is what he wrote. "I sought for the key to the greatness and genius of America in her harbors, in her fertile fields and boundless forests, in her rich mines and vast world commerce, in her public school system and institutions of learning. I sought for it in her democratic Congress and her matchless Constitution. But not until I went into the churches of America and heard her pulpits flame with righteousness did I understand the secret of her genius and power. America is great because America is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great."